with the afternoon show with Anne Forbes Cooper and
Richard Roth.
And our next two guests are, first of all, noted Hudson Valley historian and genealogist Sylvia Hassenkopf in a second visit to the afternoon show. And on the line we have Russ Oschel, who is an expert on Joel Curtis, who was Cairo's own early clockmaker, who lived in Cairo from in the 1820s, and his clock factory pumped out clocks for the masses that were sold throughout the state by travelling peddlers. And Oschel is also the author, with Helen Boyce, of An Empire in Time, which is a book describing the clocks and clockmakers of upstate New York. And Oschel will be appearing this Thursday, the 21st of July, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Gallagher's in Cairo, which is sponsored by the Cairo Historical Society. So welcome to the afternoon show, Sylvia and Russ.
Thank you.
We're delighted to have you with us today. So Russ, who was Joel Curtis and what made him tick?
Good question. Curtis was a native of Connecticut who was taught the clockmaking trade in the Plymouth, Connecticut area in the early 1800s, and who by around 1812 decided to move and establish a wooden works tall clock factory in Cairo at what was then called the Forge and is now called Purling.
So why Cairo? Any particular reason? Was there wood available, or?
Well, wood certainly was one of the things needed to produce the clocks. I think my guess is that primarily he saw the Shingle Kills Falls area as an excellent site to establish a factory and use the abundant water power there. And certainly the availability of wood, which was used in the movement, in Greene County in the area was also a factor in that even by around 1810, much of the wood used in the movements that were produced in Connecticut, where most of the manufacturers were, was actually being imported from New York State because Connecticut didn't have an adequate supply of cherry and oak at that time to produce the movement. So, yeah, the raw materials certainly were a factor as well.
So Russ, it wasn't a question of Greene County needing more timepieces because of, like, Rip Van Winkle and people not keeping track of time?
Yeah, Rip could have used the tall clock. But the woodworks tall clocks, the reason it was, even a thought in terms of producing them in Greene County, was that they were really the first clock available to the masses. Because they were made out of wood, the material could be cheaply obtained, they weren't difficult to make. Production-wise, didn't need expensive brass, for example. And I think the other factor in terms of locating in Greene County were the numerous turnpikes that originated in Greene County and went into central and southern New York State, where they could be taken even further out into western New York State, south into Pennsylvania, and into the emerging country developing at that point in central New York. So clearly the turnpikes were also a major factor.
Just so we understand, Russ, when you've mentioned now a couple of times tall clocks, what do you mean by that term?
That's the early term associated with what we now call grandfather clocks. And it was the terminology used right up until the turn of the 20th century, when the term grandfather clock became sort of synonymous with that style clock based on a song, My Grandfather's Clock, that was very popular in the 1890s. So until that time, they were generally called tall clocks.
And I'd like to add that from my perspective as a historian, the importance of Joel Curtis coming to the Cairo area really came down to Cairo lying along the Susquehanna Turnpike. It was one of the major throughfares for not only voyagers going west, but also for goods coming back out east in terms of movement of people and goods. And Caro, being along that thoroughfare, was a major way station where we saw a lot of goods being made from the tanning of leather to the clock factory to the bell factory that we had in Caro back in the day. And I think that's one of the major reasons why Joel came there.
Mm-hmm. What was the clock industry like in the U.S. at that time? Were there a lot of clock makers?
Really, up until about 1805 or so, it was difficult to procure a clock because most of the clocks were made with brass movements and were made by hand, making it really impossible for anyone other than the very well-to-do to afford them. Some makers in Connecticut, as early as the mid-1700s, were making tall clocks out of wood, but those were also handmade. So it really took a gentleman named Eli Terry, who invented machinery around 1800 or so, to mass produce the wooden clock movements using gear-cutting engines, where they could make, say, 15 or 20 similar gears at a time using saws and gear cutters. He invented that mechanism and then basically showed the world that mass production could actually take place between 1806 and 1809, where on a single contract he produced over 4,000 clock movements, where prior to that an individual's production might have totaled at most maybe 100 clocks per year. So that was a real significant change. And relating to Joel Curtis, we think, based on the design of his movements, actually studied and learned under Eli Terry, including his machine-making capabilities.
The thing I wanted to also bring up is that the use of the peddler system was really quite important in the early 19th century. As Russ mentioned, the opening of New York State and all the way into Pennsylvania was really on the backs of the turnpike system. At that time, the state was not really responsible for the maintenance and creation of roads. These turnpikes were really individual companies that were established. They petitioned the state to establish a turnpike for XYZ reason. Usually it had to do with the movement of goods and produce. And what happened is the peddlers ended up being the people that were moving the goods around. We didn't have railroads. The interior of New York State didn't have an extensive waterway system. And certainly the Erie Canal wasn't built yet prior to 1824. So the main way in which any kind of goods, and this could be from honey to tinware, to the clocks themselves, the way to get them to individuals, to the families, the farmers, the homes throughout New York State, rural New York State, was the peddler system. And so as the peddlers came through, they would pick up materials that they would then trade or exchange, not always for money, oftentimes for goods themselves, to return back east and then pick up more goods, almost like in a circular kind of fashion.
Mm-hmm. Weren't most of the clocks, tall clocks, being made in Europe at the time? Wasn't Europe and the UK the leaders back then in clock making?
Certainly in terms of fine clock making and in terms of volume, England was the leader, certainly through the 1600s, 1700s, into the 1800s. Interestingly enough, the American mass production techniques that first involved wooden works clocks, and then by about 1840 involved brass movement shelf clocks, really signaled the end of the British brass tall clock industry. So there were significant ramifications of Eli Terry's inventions in terms of mass production that affected not only American producers but worldwide producers.
Did Joel Curtis make watches as well, or was it just clocks?
Yeah, there's no evidence whatsoever that Curtis made any watches, and watchmaking really wasn't, there weren't any watchmakers using mass production techniques really until about the 1870s. And again, those were American producers who devised the machines necessary to mass produce watches. So watches really up through the mid 1800s were sort of like the early clocks. They were very expensive, and most people couldn't afford them.
Right, so having a clock then was a bit of a status symbol, was it? Only the richest people could afford them.
Absolutely, and even after there were clocks available to the masses, they were a status symbol. So typically the tall clock in the various and assorted types of cases would have been placed prominently in the front room or the dining room of your country house to show off. And to add what Sylvia said earlier, the peddlers absolutely were an important component here. And when Curtis made his clocks, he did not make the cases for his movements. He produced the movements, the dials, sold the weights and the pendulums, and then had peddlers go out in the country who would stop at a given farmhouse, and the person would buy that mechanism and either hang it right on the wall without any case, or typically find the local carpenter in town and have that carpenter make them a case, which is why there are so many variations in clock cases, from the really crude country designs to the very beautiful designs using multiple woods and veneers, etc.
I see that Joel Curtis installed a clock in the First Presbyterian Church in Cairo in 1828. Does that clock still exist?
I hope so. It doesn't exist in Cairo, as far as I know, but when I first started my research 15, 20 years ago, I interviewed several citizens in Cairo who were prior members of the Presbyterian Church, which consolidated around 1952, and the church was sold to the Methodists, and I was told that when the church was sold, all the interior furniture, etc., were sold at auction, including the tower clock that was documented to have been made by Curtis. That would have been a wooden works tower clock. One gentleman who claimed to be at the auction said it was like an oversized grandfather clock movement, which it would have been. On my most recent visit, we were able to get access to the church tower for the first time, and I in the tower, and sure enough, the stand that the movement was on is still up in the tower. You can still tell where the dial was on the church. There are pictures of the church with the old dial. So, it's clear that there was a clock in the church. It appears quite likely it came from the Cairo factory. And I was told that it sold at auction for $35, and some gentleman from Connecticut bought it. So it's all anecdotal, and hopefully it's true, and hopefully it's sitting around somewhere, hopefully soon to reemerge.
Maybe it'll show up on the Antiques Roadshow.
Right, exactly.
I keep looking.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, if somebody hears this broadcast, they'll call in and say, "I've got that clock." So that begs the question: how many of his clocks are left then?
All I can say is that I've been looking for New York State clocks and looking for New York State wooden works tall clocks for about 35 years now. And comparatively speaking, compared to all but maybe one or two of the Connecticut makers who had very large factories producing thousands of clocks a year, Curtis, by that standards, was a pretty prolific maker, probably ranking in the top five and terms of 30-hour wood tall clock production, based on the clocks that I see turning up. So by those standards, he was a high volume maker of wood tall clocks in that period, which we think now ran from about 1812 to about 1830.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the WGXC Afternoon Show. Tom Rowe here with Richard Roth and Ann Forbes Cooper, and we're talking to Russ Oschel and Sylvia Hasenkopf about the history of clockmaking in Cairo.
And so, Sylvia, why is this subject so important to Cairo?
Well, the Cairo Historical Society has put together a pretty aggressive programming schedule for the 2011 year. our mission really is to educate and to entertain the people from Caro and Greene County and the surrounding counties. We think it's really important to understand our past so that we can forge a better future for our town and, you know, as time goes on. And I was fortunate enough to connect with Russ based upon an inquiry I had from someone else who had called me about Joel Curtis clocks. And I, at that time, didn't know a heck of a lot about it, to be honest with you. And I surfed the net, found Russ's name, and was pondering how in the world I was going to get in touch with him. And lo and behold, the next day, he called me. So there's something about karma and, you know, things that are meant to happen. So Russ and I have been talking for a few months about him coming up to Caro, because he does live a little ways away, and doing this presentation to interested people in history and in understanding why clockmaking was such an important factor in our community back in the 1920s, and to also, you know, provide interesting programming. We're really excited about what we're doing this year.
Yeah. What else do you have coming up?
Next month we have a very famous and educating type of gentleman coming on board. Ron Tunison is a world-famous sculptor of Civil War monuments. Many of his monuments, in fact, stand in Gettysburg and other Civil War Civil War battlefields. And Ron is a resident of Caro, so he's happy to come on down to the Gallagher's Banquet Hall in August, the third Thursday in August at 7 o'clock, to talk about how he creates the sculptures and the planning and the process in developing these wonderful monuments to the Civil War battles. In September, we're going to be hosting the Temperance and Tommy Guns 1920 Street Festival on September 17th. We'll be closing down Main Street Caro and bringing back Legs Diamond Era, the whole bootlegging era and the simpler times of Prohibition, and providing a suite of entertainers and antique cars and a live auction from Mooney's, where we're going to kind of showcase what it was like back in the 1920s. In the evening of the 17th of September, we're going to be putting in Case's Speakeasy, which is a 1920s nightclub. We did it last year. It was an absolutely incredible success. We're doing it again this year and bringing back Terry Reuger and her Gentlemen of Swing, who are going to be, playing the lively jazz music and a few Charleston tunes to get people up there dancing. Wonderful buffet by Blima's Catering from Columbia County here, who's coming over to entertain us from our palates. And it should prove to be a very fun evening. People had a great time last year, and we're expecting that this year as well.
And people dress accordingly, do they? They get their flapper frocks out.
Oh, they do. Last year we had 75 people. I think there's only a couple people that did not come fully attired. And you don't have to come in an outfit, but I think people just love that time frame, and they love coming in their pinstripes and love coming with their flapper outfit. Mm-hmm. And certainly you have to have your password to get in the front door. That comes with your ticket. And if you're interested in more information on that, feel free to reach out to us at our Facebook page, Caro Historical Society, under the events section, and you'll find out the ticket information and so on for the Case's Speakeasy. Now, the Temperance and Tommy Guns event, the day event, is free.
Okay. And Russ, just to get back to the subject at hand, why are you so interested in clocks?
That's a good question. I think it's just... It certainly have an interest in history. I was a history major in college. It was just something that sort of hit me, I guess, after my wife and I got married and we started to go to flea markets. For some reason, antique clocks seemed to attract our interest. And then I moved soon after that to Central New York when I went to grad school at Syracuse. And in scouring the countryside, found a number of Central New York and upstate New York clockmakers, existing clocks, and found that no one had done any research on them. So that spark and my interest in doing historical research sort of joined together, and I've been doing that for about 35 years. And so far, we've documented over 175 individuals in the clockmaking trade from basically south of Albany, including Caro, all the way to Buffalo in the period 1800 to about the 1920s. So we found a lot more than we thought we would.
Was upstate New York particularly known for clockmakers then?
Certainly there were many notable makers, but most of them actually emigrated up into New York State from Connecticut. Most of them had roots in the Connecticut clockmaking world, and Connecticut was really the center of the clockmaking in the world. Starting by about the 1840s, right on through the 1920s. So many of those individuals trained in the trade in Connecticut moved with the mass migrations that took place starting in the 1820s and onward. And when they came up here, they thought they'd try their hand at the trade they knew. And virtually, not all of them, but most of them found out that there was no way they could compete with the Connecticut mass producers, and so their clockmaking careers were short-lived, which makes most of the upstate New York clocks rather rare today.
Hmm. And is there an industry today in clockmaking?
Interestingly enough, no. Most of the American clockmaking industry was gone after World War II. And clock production went over to lower cost production countries such as Japan and then Korea and now China. So sort of the natural progression of economics and the cost of production, as with many previously manufactured goods in the United States, they're just no longer made here.
Okay. Russ, is there anything else that you'd like to add about Joel Curtis or clockmaking in America?
I don't think so. I want to thank you for inviting me. I want to thank Sylvia for inviting me. Hopefully we'll have a few folks at the session on Thursday. And I know there's going to be some local residents who have Joel Curtis clocks. They're going to be bringing them to the show, so we'll be able Ooh. To look at and handle some of those clocks, which should be a lot of fun.
And it sounds like it'll be a fascinating presentation. And Sylvia, is there anything you'd like to add?
Certainly. One of the things that Russ and I have been talking quite extensively about between ourselves and also with local residents is where exactly was that clock factory? And I'm not going to give you that answer today. That's something you have to come on down to. The Carroll Historical Society meeting on the 21st at 7 o'clock at Gallagher's Banquet Hall, which is at 513 Main Street in Carroll, to find out that answer. It's been an interesting journey trying to figure out, using the historical records, exactly where that clock factory stood. And I think Russ and I have done a pretty good job in figuring that out, and we're looking forward to sharing that on Thursday.
Okay.
Right. We're right according to us.
Well, that's true.
Okay, so if you want to learn the answer to that mystery, go to the presentation on Thursday. Well, once again, thank you so much, Sylvia Hasenkopf and Russ Oschel. Thank you
thank
for
you,
being
Anna
on the show.
Thank you.
And I think we may have the version of grandfather clock song. We have a version by Johnny Cash. We'll see if it's the same
Great.
Song or not. We'll play that now
okay.
on BGXC. Thanks, Russ.
Sure.
Way down south, down a long dusty road, there's an old ramshackle house that nobody lives in anymore. And if you walk down the hall and look, you'll see an old grandfather's clock that don't run anymore. It's silent now and it's covered up with spider webs. That was my grandfather's clock, and this song is a story of that clock. My grandfather's clock was too large for the shelf, so it stood 90 years on the floor. It was taller by half than the old man himself, though it weighed not a penny weight more. It was bought on the morn of the day that he was born, and was always his treasure and pride. But it stopped short, never to go again when the old man died. And my grandfather said that of those he could hire, not a servant so faithful he found. for it wasted no time, and it had but one desire, at the close of each week to be wound. And it kept in its place, not a frown upon its face, and its hands never hung by its side. But it stopped short, never to go again, when the old man died. 90 years without slumbering, tick-tock, tick-tock, his life seconds numbering. Tick-tock, tick-tock, it stopped short, never to go again, when the old man died. Well, it rang an alarm in the still of the night, an alarm that for years had been dumb. And we knew that his spirit was pluming for flight, that his hour for departure had come. Still the clock kept the time with a soft and muffled chime, as we silently stood by his side. But it stopped short, never to go again, when the old man died. 90 years without slumbering, tick-tock, tick-tock, his life seconds numbering. Tick-tock, tick-tock, it stopped short, never to go again, when the old man died. And I've been thinking that someday I'm going down to my grandpa's old house, and I'm going to get that old clock, and I'm going to shine it up, and I'm going to oil it up good, and get it fixed up pretty, and it'll keep time for me, just like it did for my grandpa.